morning. Nice to see all of you here this morning. A couple of quick announcements. Okay, first of all, the homework assignment that you turned in to me for Friday for class has been graded, and I always hand them back in a set of boxes. Many of you are familiar with these, but as you go walking from here down to the lab room, you know, you take that left and then the right, and the lab room's down there. You find that big set of brown boxes that are hanging on the wall across from the bathroom, and that's where I turn back things. That's where I post exam scores and all that kind of stuff. So as you look at that, that's also where I think some of you are probably turning in your lab assignments too, those of you that are in Erica's lab. So anyway, as you look at there on the left, you'll find one column that has my name above it. It's all alphabetized. That's where I turn things back. And so all of those, what I'll do, once those assignments come in, I'll print them, I'll grade them, and then turn them back by putting them in those boxes. So at least right now, they're all alphabetical, unless I messed up. As time goes on, sometimes they have a way of migrating up and down, but I try to keep them as straight as possible. So you can get your first homework assignment back and take a look at it. I've also posted the answers for that homework assignment in the display case, the glass display case right next to it on the left. So you can see what the answers really were. Actually, most of you did great on it. There were only a few little problems that showed up every once in a while. The purpose of that first assignment was to really get you to looking at some of the materials that are available in the class. For example, the reason I had you download that first review sheet and attach it was so that I would know you'd actually been there. You see, that's where you can always go back and get the review sheets for every lecture. So this review sheet's been posted. It's been there for a while now. And that's the same place where you can download the audio file if you want to listen to a lecture again. Or you can, sometimes I'll have YouTube links there for various things. You know, so it's a pretty useful page for a lot of people. So, and most of you were managed to get there and actually download that PDF file and attach it and send it back to me. So that was good. Some of the others, like you always hear about the CDC, Center for Disease Control, I think a lot of people don't really understand what they do, so that's one of the reasons I had you go there and take a look and kind of get a feel for their history a little bit, some of the things that they've done and whatnot. So there was that and whatnot. So that was really kind of the purpose behind that assignment. There is another assignment due this Friday, so make sure that you go onto Moodle and you download that file and you get it into me by 1:30 on Friday. You have an option from this point on. If you want to word process it and turn it in that way, that's fine. You can either turn it into my office or to me in lecture. You can turn it on Thursday in lecture or something. Never, never return assignments in the boxes where I return assignments, because I never look for them there and I never find. It's only by accident that sometimes I'll find an assignment that had been sitting there for maybe 2 or 3 weeks and think, what in the world is this doing here? So you always will return them to my office under the door if I'm not there, or to lecture, or email. You know, email is a very, very convenient way to go ahead and return those assignments. Again, I would much prefer if you put the answers for an email, turn in the answers in the body of the email itself. If you feel compelled to attach a file with the answers on it, and some of you do always, please make sure and put your name on the attachment, because once I've printed those, it's separated from your email, and I'll get to this whole stack of things. I'll start grading them. I'll start sorting them out and stuff, and all of a sudden, I've got an email attachment with no name on it. I'll look at that and I think, I wonder whose that was. So I've got to go. I mean, I have my ways of figuring it out, but it takes a lot of time. So please be sure and remember to put your name on. It was really good. There were a few of you that sent attachments for the assignment, and only one of you didn't put your name on it. So that was really good. I've seen as many as 5 or 6 nameless attachments before, and it's kind of crazy. So make sure that you do that. So you can always do that if you really want it. If you really feel the need to do that, you can do it that way. So don't forget that that's due Friday. There may have been another announcement. if I think of it, I'll let you know, but that's all I can think of right now. So let's dive in. Let's see where we're headed now. So last time, you know, we did a little thing with the brain that was the most enjoyable experience for most of you, I'm sure. But talking about structure and function and how they're so intimately related. And of course, we've been looking in lab at tissues, and tissues being kind of the structural building blocks for the various organs. So we looked at that whole issue again a little bit there in that lab. And then we talked about homeostasis, thought about that a little bit. And again, that's going to be kind of an ongoing theme in this term. We're going to be looking at so many different processes that go on within the body, and so many of them are involved in homeostasis, in maintaining constant levels of this or that within the body. How do we do that? How do we make sure there's enough oxygen in the blood? How do we make sure we're getting rid of that CO2? These are all things that we want to maintain at relatively constant levels, so we'll be looking at those kinds of things. So we saw that really, when we're thinking about homeostasis, there are three elements to it, right? There's a level that's being monitored. We call that the set point. But what's the set point? What's the level that we're monitoring? That's kind of the level that we want that material to be at. Now, it's not, as we saw last time, it's not like it's absolutely at that level all the time. It's going to fluctuate up and down a little bit. But it's going to, there's a range of that level that we want the material to be at. And then we got a sensor, of course, some sort of a sensor that's monitoring that. And the function of the sensor isn't so much to set that level. It doesn't set the level. The function of the sensor, remember, is to detect errors from that level. And when there are errors from that level, then that sensor communicates with an effector or a series of effectors. In some systems, there's only a single effector that's involved in correcting the problem. In other systems, there's more than one. There's several. And we'll look at least one of those during the course of the quarter when we think about how do we maintain the level of sugar in the blood over the long term and so forth. So a couple of effectors involved there. So that effector then is something that's going to take some sort of an action to bring us back to the set point, right? So homeostasis, a homeostatic control mechanism, that's a very, very important thing for us in maintaining constancy. So I'll be highlighting that from time to time with you all. And then finally, we started talking about the digestive system, and that's where we're headed today. And we'll probably spend all day on Thursday, too, just talking about the digestive system. Now, last time, I just introduced you to some ideas. You know, what are the four functions, the four basic functions of the digestive system? We saw that getting the food in, and you know, the mouth, the pharynx, back of the throat area, the esophagus, those are all involved in just getting that food in. There was processing of the food, and we're going to talk more about that today. Processing starts in the mouth, it continues in the stomach, continues in the small intestine. We talked about absorption of the nutrients a little bit. You know, once we get the food in, once we got it processed, what do we do next? Well, we got to absorb it into the body. And so primarily we'll see this happening in the small and large intestine, though some absorption occurs in other areas too, but not a terribly great amount. And then finally, elimination of waste. How do we get rid of those things that maybe didn't get digested, or those things that got digested and didn't get absorbed? And there are a lot of other things. One of the things I'll be talking with you about is the fact that when we think of feces, fecal pellets, things like that, it's more than half bacteria that are growing in our gut. When we don't want their populations to overgrow, and so we get rid of a lot of bacteria. Also, so how do we get rid of waste? So we'll be talking about that a little bit at the end also. So that's kind of where we're headed. Now, what I'd like to do today is we're kind of in the middle of page 6 in the lecture notes, overview of structures and functions. So let's take a look at, just get a feel for what the different pieces are, okay, a little bit more what they look like. And I'll tell you maybe a little bit about some of the things they're doing. But then once we've had a look at kind of the digestive system as a whole, then we'll go back and we'll start looking more specifically at processing. How do we process the food and so forth? So that's where we're headed today. So you got this diagram on page 6. One thing I can tell you about this diagram is that I can guarantee you that on the first exam there will be a diagram of this sort. And the kinds of questions that will be being asked will be things like, you know, what is the structure of, and of course relate to, primarily relate to the digestive system. What's the structure doing? Which of these structures here does this or that? Just kind of seeing what you know about that. Okay, so there's going to be a diagram like this on the exam, so it would be good for you to take a close look at this or the one that you have in your text, which will be slightly different, but you know, it's going to be the same stuff, right? Except the one in the text will be in full, almost living color, which sometimes makes it a little bit easier to figure out what different structures are. So I can promise you that. Any diagram that I give you is always fair game for winding up on an exam or something to ask you about. This one I can guarantee is going to be there. So keep that in mind. So what do we got? We've got that. And you know what I'm going to put a kind of a color. This is pretty sad. That's what we really look like inside. I'll put that one up there so that we can kind of go back and forth, but I'm going to kind of focus on this one because this is the one that you've got in your lecture note packet there. So as we think about the digestive system, we're going to start way up here again at the mouth. That's part of it, and we're going to wind up down here at the anus. Okay, so most of what's packed in your abdominal cavity has to do with digestive processes and things. I shouldn't say most of it, but certainly a tremendous amount of what's in your abdominal cavity is involved in handling the food that you take in and processing it and absorbing it and so forth. But we'll bring it in at the top and shoot it out at the bottom. Maybe not shoot it, but so the mouth. The mouth has a bunch of different components, and I'm not going to dwell on this by any means. You're familiar with what's in your mouth. You need to be especially familiar when it comes to an exam. But you know, so if we were looking into someone's mouth, what are we going to see? All sorts of fun things, right? Like teeth. Well, teeth are really important because what do the teeth do? They help us to break apart and break down the material that we're taking in. And breaking that material down into smaller, more manageable pieces is really critically important to the whole digestive process. We'll be talking about enzymes and how enzymes are involved in breaking our food down into smaller units that we can actually absorb. Enzymes work on surfaces. You know, let's just imagine a piece of bread maybe or something like that. You take a piece of bread, a big loaf of bread, okay? If you were to just swallow the whole loaf of bread, maybe it's a smaller roll or something, your ability to digest that would be much, much lower than if you were to break that up into much smaller pieces. Because by breaking it up into smaller pieces, you're winding up with more surface area. And the enzymes are going to be operating at the surface area. Okay, so that's how they're able to get in there and attack the large food molecules that you've eaten. And so breaking that food up into smaller pieces really is very important. Now, none of you had a mother that said, now chew your food 20 times before you swallow it and little things like that. Have any of you ever tried to chew your food 20 times? You mean, I've tried, it's hard. It's like, oh, I'm only at 10, I've got 10 more to go. But the reasoning behind that is that the more we chew our food, the smaller pieces we get it into, the more solubilized we get it, and the better able we're going to be to efficiently digest it. So there's actually sense behind that statement, though my mother did not tell me that either. She just tried to feed me brains. But there's sense to that, but we're kind of in a rush world, and oftentimes just gobbling it down as fast as we can. Gobble it down as fast as you can, and you wonder a couple hours later why you got a stomachache, you know. Maybe it's not solubilizing as well. So anyway, the teeth are involved in that, right? Now, what keeps the food in the mouth while you're working over it with the teeth? Lips, right? So have you ever been around somebody who eats with their mouth open and food comes flying out for one reason or another? Maybe that happens more if you're a big cat and you got a mouse you're eating or something, but Yeah, the lips, once you've taken food in, the lips seal that opening, right, so that you can chew it without losing food out the side of the mouth or something like that. And that's a very good thing. You don't want to be losing your food that way. We're going to run into muscles like the lips in several places in the digestive tract. The lips are what we call a sphincter muscle. A sphincter muscle runs circularly, and when those muscles contract, they can shut off that opening. Or when they relax, they can open that opening. Sphincter muscles are really important for controlling things as they move along. So we're going to run into them in several places. The first place we run into them is at the mouth. The last place where we run into them is at the anus. So both ends sealed off by sphincter muscles and a couple more places in between. So the lips help us to shut the mouth, close off the cavity. The tongue is there. The tongue, have you ever tried to chew something without moving your tongue? I challenge you to do that. That would be an interesting experiment. We're constantly moving things around in our mouth with our tongues, right? And that's part of the chewing process. I think if you weren't moving things around with your tongue, like if you've been to a dentist who really loves to use the deadening, some sort of sadistic dentist who completely deadens your tongue, and then you go and try to eat some. Of course, they'll tell you don't eat anything because you'll eat your tongue too, because you can't feel it, but it's really, really hard to do that. So the tongue's really involved too, all of these things. Now, of course, the tongue and the lips are and the teeth too are really useful for other things like talking, right? So we take advantage of them that way too, but in terms of digestive processes, they're really, really important. As you chew and chew and chew, then you're kind of liquefying, and we'll come back to some of these processes in a little bit, but you're kind of liquefying that food, and you want to get it liquefied to at least a certain level. Have you ever tried to swallow dry food? Accidentally, you might do that. It's not fun. You know, your food needs to be liquefied well enough to actually get it to slide down the esophagus. So you're chewing that, but as you're chewing and processing, the food's gradually working its way to the back, to the pharynx. Okay, so the back of the mouth, the throat region, is what we call the pharynx. Now, pharynx is kind of an interesting area because we have a couple of things going on that are associated with the head, right? Not only are we taking food in, but we're taking air in. So we have air passageways also. And we got it, that air can either go in through the mouth or through the sinus cavities. And in a few weeks when we're dissecting the veal pigs, you'll be cutting the mouth open and looking for the opening in the top of the palate where the sinus cavity is empty, so air can go down that way or through the mouth. So in the back of the throat, in the pharynx region, we have two tubes that are back there. There's the esophagus, which is going to take your food to your stomach. There's the trachea, which is going to allow air to flow in and out of the lungs. Now, one of the things that we don't want to have happen is to fill up our lungs with food. And sadly, in some older people, you can actually forget how to swallow. Believe it or not, swallowing is kind of a learned reflex, even though you kind of do it automatically, you can forget how to swallow. And that becomes a real problem for some older people where they don't have a good swallow reflex. And so when they swallow, their air passageway doesn't close off well. And food starts to get into the lungs. And as you can imagine, it creates all kinds of problems when that happens. So what do we have going on back there? There's some diagrams. Let's take a peek over at the next page. So you've got the diagram there at the top that is a diagram just of the mouth, the pharynx region. Okay, so we've been talking about these things. Here are the teeth, the lips, the tongue, air passageway coming down up through the sinus. They're assuming that this is a person that only breathes through their nose at this point. Now, of course, the mouth is closed, so that would be tough to breathe through the mouth. It comes back here, and the normal passageway for air is to come back here. Here's the pharynx, the kind of the common region for both of those tubes. And then the trachea sits in front of the esophagus. The esophagus sits in the back. You can feel your trachea, right? You can put your finger down here and you can feel the cartilaginous ridges on your trachea. And as I'm sitting here talking, it's moving up, down, doing all sorts of weird things. That's the air passageway. That's how we get air in and out of the lungs.
the esophagus sitting here to the rear of the trachea, that's where we need to shove the food down to get it down to the stomach. So to keep it from the keep the food from actually just going down into the trachea, we have this little cartilagin structure called the epiglottis that sits in the back here. And you'll get a chance again to see that on your fetal pigs when you take them apart. Epiglottis, very cartilaginous in nature, and what happens is when you get that mass of food to the back of your throat, you start to push it down. One thing that it does is that it pushes the epiglottis down over the opening to the trachea. So the epiglottis is going to protect the trachea. The opening to the trachea, by the way, you wonder, where does that word epiglottis come from? That's a really weird term. The opening to the trachea, which would be right here, is called the glottis. T-T-I-S. That's the glottis. So the epiglottis sits right above it, and that's where that term comes from. The epiglottis is going to seal that. Now, it can't seal it on its own. It's not so big that just the epiglottis being pushed down by the food will do it. So the second thing that happens when you swallow, and you can try this, just put your hand on your trachea and go ahead and swallow, you'll see that the trachea moves up. Okay, so that's part of shutting that glottis off with the epiglottis. So not only is it folding down, but the trachea is pushing up to shut that whole thing on. So don't ever try to breathe and swallow at the same time. It won't work. You're going to shut off your trachea as you're swallowing. And for most of us, it works just fine. You know, every so often you start to cough and choke because you get something like, usually it's a liquid down the wrong tube, you say. We can be kind of lazy sometimes in our eating, and liquidy things can kind of get back into the throat without causing a swallow reflex, and then all of a sudden it's going down the trachea and you're coughing and hacking and so forth. What we'd really like to do is to be able to swallow every time, right? And that'll take care of that. So anyway, with swallowing, two things. The epiglottis gets pushed down, the trachea gets pushed up, and that seals it off adequately so that we're not filling our lungs with food. So we got this mass of food now that's moving down the esophagus. You know, it's interesting. People are always surprised, and it's okay. You can be surprised. When we are looking at the fetal pigs later on, people oftentimes think of the esophagus as just this kind of hollow tube that connects the back of the throat to the stomach. Okay, it's the food passage, hollow tube, food goes down. So obviously if you're standing up or sitting up and you're eating your food, that food's just falling down the tube and it's getting to the stomach. But you know, you can swallow food when you're laying down. You can swallow food while you're standing on your head. And it'll still get to the stomach. And it turns out that the esophagus is a very, very muscular organ. And most of the time, it's the opening is closed. I mean, the muscles in relaxing, it just kind of collapses down. So really, when the food gets back there, when the food gets pushed back into the pharynx, down past the trachea, into the esophagus, that food mass is expanding this muscular esophagus. There are what we call peristaltic waves that then send that food down to the stomach. And they're caused by muscles in here. So peristaltic waves, or another term just referring to this process you might see is just called peristalsis. So these are waves of muscle that are alternately contracting and relaxing that are literally pushing that food down through the esophagus to the stomach. So that's how we get it down there. Now the digestive system from the beginning of the esophagus all the way to the other end has a certain composition, a structural composition. Remember, structure and function again. So I'd like to talk with you just a little bit about the way this whole thing is put together from the esophagus on down and out the anus, okay, and a very common structure. And you've got a diagram of that down there at the bottom of page 7. And let me pull out my diagram, a little bit bigger diagram, maybe a little bit clearer to see things. There are basically four layers to the various regions, various organs of the digestive system. Basically four layers. The innermost layer is the one that changes the most from region to region to region, that gives us different things going on in different regions. The outer layers tend to be fairly repetitive in what they look like. So let's look at this from the outside in. So the first layer, if we were to take, let's say we take an esophagus and we took a cross-section of it and we're looking at what are the different tissue types and so forth that are causing it, that are forming it, the outer layer is this layer that we call the serosa. Okay, that's a lot of connective tissue, it's a lot of epithelial tissue, because epithelial tissues line surfaces, right? The serosa is just that outer coating, and it at one position it will come together and it will form these membranes that we call the mesenteries. Now the mesenteries are continuous with the inside of the body cavity. So inside the body cavity we're going to find more of these kinds of membranes that are coating the whole inside of the body cavity. The whole point in this, the mesenteries then hold the organs in place, at least for the digestive tract. Everything's kind of tied together now, held in position, because we have this outer layer of the digestive tract that's continuous as a mesentery with the inner layer of the abdominal cavity. And that means that when you're out, when you're a kid and you're jumping all over the place and doing handstands and really weird tumbling things, that's why your digestive system doesn't get all tangled up and tied up. All right, everything's kind of held into position. So you can do weird things and not have problems with that. That holds things in place. That's what the mesenteries do, is to help to hold things in place. And you'll be able to see some of those if you look for them again later on when we look at the fetal pigs. So the outer layer is the serosa. It's just kind of, you would look at it, it's kind of like a membrane of sorts, but it's composed of some different tissues that form that membrane. The next layer in on this diagram is called the muscle layer. On your diagram is called the muscularis. Muscularis. Those are smooth muscles. Smooth muscles that are running in two different directions. So the outer part has those smooth muscles that are running up and down the length of the digestive tract of where we're at. Okay, so they're longitudinal, meaning they're running up and down the length. So when they contract, they're going to shorten, they're going to make that digestive tract shorter. And when you do that, it makes it bigger around. Okay, so they'll do that. And then inside that is the layer of circular muscles. So circular in here, longitudinal. Out here, the circular muscles, their orientation is in circularly around the organ, right? And so when they contract, they're going to get smaller. They're going to decrease the size of this opening, and to do that, they're going to lengthen the digestive tract out. So we have muscles, yeah.
Are the circular muscles part of the muscularis?
Yes. Yeah, the muscularis is a general term for the muscular layer, and then you've got both the circular and the longitudinal in there. So we have opposing muscles, and that's kind of a trend that we're going to see also to make something move. What a muscle will do is primarily shorten in length. Now, if you give it time, it will elongate out again, but there's no mechanism in the muscle to really allow it to efficiently elongate out. The way that we cause a muscle fiber that's contracted to lengthen again, the most efficient way, is to have an opposing set of muscles that when they contract, they lengthen out the other set of muscles. And we have that on our skeleton. You know, our skeletal muscles are always in pairs. We have the bicep. When I flex my bicep, it brings my lower arm up. And we have the tricep on the back. When I flex my tricep, it brings the lower arm down. Well, as that lower arm is being brought down,
by flexing the tricep, that's stretching out the bicep. And vice versa, as the bicep brings up the arm, then that's stretching out the tricep. So we have pairs of muscles that work in opposition to each other, that one will contract, the other will stretch to allow movement to occur. And we see that same thing here. It's the circular and the longitudinal muscles that perform that particular function. So when one set contracts, the other one will be lengthened. When the other one lengthens, the first set will stretch out again. When the other set contracts, that set will stretch out again. Yeah. So we generally tend to find muscles in pairs like that, sets in pairs, and we'll see that throughout the digestive tract, from the top to the bottom. So we've got the serosa out here. We've got the muscularis in here. Now the next layer is called the submucosa. And it's in the submucosa where we find the main blood vessels and lymph vessels and nerves. So the big blood and lymph vessels, the arteries that are running in, the veins that are running out, they're all going into or originating from the submucosa, and then nerves going in. Now, the blood vessels and the lymphatic vessels are going to spread out from there. Okay, but that's, if you track them, you'd see that they're going into this layer right here. And then finally, the mucosa is the inner layer, the lining layer, and we find that the small blood vessels and the small lymph vessels, the capillaries and so forth, are going up into the mucosa, especially in areas where we're absorbing nutrients and stuff. We got to have a good blood supply to be able to absorb those nutrients into and so forth. So we find the small blood and lymph vessels up in this area in the mucosa. And the mucosa is also the area that changes the most. It's the most specific from region to region for whatever the function that part of the digestive tract is going to do. So we see that the mucosa will look a certain way in areas, say the first part of the small intestine, where we're really focusing on digesting the materials yet. The mucosa is going to be producing some enzymes that are involved in the digestive process, a lot of enzymes involved in the digestive process. But as we move farther down the small intestine and we begin to absorb nutrients, then that mucosa is going to change, and it's going to change quite dramatically. It will no longer be producing digestive enzymes. We've already put all those into the mix. But it will increase its surface area, so you get a lot more, because when we absorb the nutrients out of the material that's flowing through, we want to absorb as much as we can over as short a period of time and as short a length as we can. So we'll talk later on about how the surface of those cells begin to have a whole bunch of projections on them and so forth to increase the surface area. And that's to allow them to be much more efficient in absorbing the material. So it's that mucosa that's going to change the most. The mucosa in the stomach would look different from the mucosa in the small intestine. The mucosa in the stomach is going to produce a certain amount of digestive materials that we'll talk about in a few minutes that are going to be very different from the mucosa in the small intestine. So that's the layer that changes the most. The mucosa in the esophagus would be relatively smooth. Well, that's if you get it stretched out. Some of the cells will produce some fluids that will help to lubricate the esophagus so that you can get the food down, even though you've worked at lubricating the food with or liquefying the food with the saliva. You'll get even more material to help that food move down. So the lining of the cells lining or of the mucosa in the esophagus will look different. That'll look different from the stomach, look different from the first part of the small intestine, from the second part, and so on. So that's really where the significant change is going to occur. All the regions have a serosa around them. All of them have this muscularis layer. All of them have the submucosa where the blood vessels and lymph vessels and stuff are going into and so forth. But then this mucosa is the one that's going to change the most. And you can see on your diagram, well, this one too, that
There are also, we're going to talk about some glands that are involved. Glands produce fluids for us. And the fluids get put into the whole mixture through ducts. So we'll talk a little bit about that too. So every so often we might find a gland with a duct attached, the duct feeding in to the intestine at one point or another. So that's the general diagram again of the digestive tract from the top of the esophagus all the way to the bottom of the anal canal, and the anus being the final ring of muscles that seals that off. So if we go back now, we were talking about these peristaltic waves, right? So now you can see they're the longitudinal and circular muscles that are alternately contracting and relaxing that are responsible for pushing that food down. And eventually, it's going to push that food down into the stomach. Now the stomach, let's see, what have you got here? I don't think you have this diagram. No, the only diagram you've got of the stomach, unfortunately, is that invisible man diagram. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute and highlight certain things on that diagram. The stomach looks like this in orientation and so forth. Here's the esophagus coming down, feeding in. So it's esophagus is carrying the food into the stomach. The stomach is very muscular. We talked about the muscularis layer, very, very muscular. The stomach churns a tremendous amount, kind of keeping things mixed up, working at solubilizing things and so forth. Stomach is a great asset to any animal because we can put our food in the stomach. It can be processed while we're out walking around doing other things. There are some animals that are just stuck. They literally, like starfish, they'll open up a clam and they'll literally stick their stomach out. Once they get the clam open, they'll stick their stomach out into the clam with digestive fluids and absorb the nutrients kind of on the half shell. But obviously they're not out walking around while they're doing that. They're kind of stuck in place. So we're lucky. We can grab a lunch on the go, chew every bite 20 times, and walk around with things getting processed. Very muscular, very active, so how do we keep the food in the stomach? Well, that's the problem. Sometimes we don't, right? And people throw up. That's not a pleasant sight. There's another sphincter muscle right at this level. Okay, that ordinarily is tightly closed. That keeps the food in the stomach at that site. When someone throws up, that sphincter muscle has relaxed, and great contractions of the stomach forces that liquefied food up and out in a direction it really shouldn't be going, but the muscles really don't care which way the food's traveling. It's wherever they start, the food's going to go in that direction, away from that. So one sphincter muscle, just for the sake of argument, it's called the cardiac sphincter. That sits at this position. So when you swallow, that has to relax. It allows the food to go down into the stomach. There's another sphincter muscle sitting at this level called the pyloric sphincter. And as that food in the stomach is liquefied, then that pyloric sphincter starts to relax and it starts the muscular contraction of the stomach start to squirt that liquefied food on into the small intestine. So our next organ here is the small intestine. But shortly after a meal, both of these sphincter muscles are closed tightly off, and that gives you this churning bag of liquefying food that we carry around with us there. Stomach has the same cross-sectional structure. Remember that? It's the same four layers. That's the same from the esophagus all the way out. So it just looks a little different. You can see that the mucosa is more ridged and so forth to produce more surface area in there. It's really good. If your mucosa is producing, we'll give you a second. If your mucosa is producing fluids that are needed, then the more surface area you have, the more of that fluid you can produce. Okay, so surface area is always a question. Okay.
So
movement is getting down, right? Just mass movement is not being absorbed by a large sinker. And so that's just going to push anything down. You
think of it in terms of like a two-hour meal or something. You're accumulating food in your stomach, and it's that food that's coming in that's pushing its way in. So the muscles of the esophagus are going to be pushing down, and that's going to prevent this. And another thing, okay, I'm not positive about this, but I would think that the stomach would be relaxing a little bit while that's happening. So you can overload the stomach. Not a pleasant thing. Right, you can shove so much food in there that you wish you would never eat again. Yeah.
There's all those different things out there. I had butterflies in my stomach. That sensation, is that actually the sensation of feeling in our stomach region, or is that something that's totally different?
Well, it's probably you're running around with your phone, probably swallowing. I'm sorry, I can't. There's dropping sensation.
Really?
Okay. But there are nerves that are involved, that are actually involved in all the digestion processes. And like, you know how if you always eat at the same time of the day, you might have more preparation, so it's a little bit easier to be trying to less spread up the ingestion and space of your stomach, your bowels. So there are nerves that are involved in this process, so causes.
Anybody else know better? I'm always open to their interpretations. And I'm sorry?
Oh gosh, I don't know what so the question was, doesn't it have to do with adrenaline? And adrenaline certainly does a lot of things when you get that. But I honestly don't know what its effect is on the stomach. I know that adrenaline will cause some quick changes in your circulatory patterns, and maybe that could be part of this, because your blood supply is going to quickly quit supplying the stomach very much, and it's going to go to other areas. But I don't know if that's really what would cause the sensation or not. Good questions. Okay, any more questions I can't answer? That was fun.
Let's go back. So here he is. Okay. I just want to say a few more things here, and then we're going to take a break here. So what have we got going on? There's the mouth, the pharynx back here. Here's the epiglottis, and let's see. So you might want to label the epiglottis there. That's the little thing sticking out there. And my arrow is just never going to point in the right direction. It's close. So that would be the epiglottis. So when you swallow, that's going to push down. The trachea is going to push up. You're going to seal it off. That's going to force your food into this tube. Now, the esophagus, unfortunately, in this drawing was drawn like it's an open pipe. But remember, it's not an open pipe. It's really a kind of a collapsed muscular, very, very muscular tube. So it's going to come down. So now we get into here. It gets busy. So the stomach is, how have they drawn that here? It kind of goes like this. So when something goes underneath another organ, they draw it in dotted lines, right? So dotted lines means something's underneath. And
on my color guide, I always see it a little bit better. Yeah, I may not have drawn that exactly right. There's the stomach sitting partly underneath the liver. Here's the liver, it's a huge organ that is off the right side. There's the stomach.
Esophagus to stomach. The stomach is going to empty into the small intestine, whose opening, I can't find the connection here, but this is the small intestine down here. Okay, and we'll talk more about the small intestine. It's about 20, 21 feet long. There's a lot of it packed in to your abdominal cavity. That small intestine, that's where we're going to see that the majority of the digestion and absorption occurs. That will open into the large intestine, which in us goes up one side, across the middle, and then down the other side. So ascending going up, transverse going across, and descending going down. You do not need to remember those terms. But that's the large intestine, which then empties in the rectum is down here, storage, and then the rectal canal and the anus down here. So those are those parts. The other parts that I want to call attention to right now, because I'm going to be talking about them in a few minutes. Well, of course, the liver. We can see the liver easily. Underneath the liver is the gallbladder. Now, that's just a little piece of the gallbladder sticking out. And actually, show that that's one of the reasons I put this diagram right here, because the gallbladder shows up much better here. And when we get a chance, again, when we're looking at the fetal pigs, we'll see that that gallbladder is up underneath the liver, almost embedded in one of the lobes of the liver. You can take it apart. Yeah. You know what? I'll be talking about the gallbladder in a few minutes. So if I don't answer your question, I think I will. But if I don't, that's it. Okay, so there's the gallbladder up under there. Very important, bile storage. We'll come back to that. Here's the pancreas. Pancreas is very important for production of digestive enzymes. From the aspect of the digestive tract, but other things too. So now the pancreas is right here. It just kind of is poking out, and then it's underneath. Okay, so it's another one of these dotted line things that's underneath the stomach, and generally you can only see a little bit of it poking out, if any at all. So that's the pancreas. What else? The appendix down here. Called the cecum in some animals, very important because bacteria inhabit that and they help to digest cellulose, things like that for us. Not that we don't digest cellulose, it's sometimes more of a pain than anything. What else on this diagram? Let me see. Gallbladder, liver, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that kind of identifies most of the things there. Okay. So. Let me just say one more thing kind of to complete this, or a couple more things to complete this thought, and then we'll take a quick break. The digestive tract is interesting. We're on page 8. If you think of it, it's oftentimes thought of as a tube within a tube. Okay, tube within a tube. What in the world does that mean, a tube within a tube? And I was infatuated with a little guy that I saw one time called, that I call affectionately Donut Man, because not only do I like donuts, but it makes a point. If you were to take a donut, okay, so we've got a donut here. I didn't give you a picture of Donut Man. We've got a donut here, and that's an old-fashioned donut. That's a good donut. But if you were to take that donut, just imagine this, if you were to take this donut, and grab it on the top and the bottom and stretch it up. So now we're making this donut into a cylinder, which would be an even better donut because there's more of it. But we're making it up into a cylinder. We're kind of then creating what we have with the digestive tract. So the hole in the middle of the donut that we're expanding is kind of like the digestive tract that I described. And the rest of the donut out there is kind of like the rest of the body, though I'd hate to see a donut with arms and legs. But it would be that sort of a thing, right? So if we were to take that and kind of stretch that up like that, then we have this tube within a tube. So the digestive tract is the one tube in here, and then the other tube is the body itself. Now, if you look at that, the diagram that you've got at the top, page 8 in the lecture notes, this kind of, it shows sort of the same thing, although it makes you think that we're wrong or not. That's the digestive tract. Laid out. So here's the mouth and everything we've talked about. There's the esophagus. There's the stomach. There's the small intestine. There's the large intestine. There's the anus. He comes in here. Everything happens. It drops out there and is left behind. Again, a tube. So this is the tube within the rest of the tube. Now, the reason I make that point is that nothing
becomes a part, truly a part of your body, until it's absorbed into the body. Okay, notice that this tube is open at both ends. Right? So we got an opening here to the environment, we have an opening here to the environment. It's open at both ends. Now there may be some sphincter muscles along the way and so forth, but it's open at both ends. Whatever you take in to your mouth is on its way out to the anus unless it's digested, unless it's absorbed, and especially unless it's absorbed. The point at which something becomes part of your body is that point at which it gets absorbed into the body, in one way or another. Okay, so we'll talk about absorption later on. So little kids can swallow pennies, right? And parents panic. And parents for the next 24, 48 hours are sifting through the output of the kid, making sure those pennies come out, right? But you can swallow things on one end and they'll come out the other end. They don't become a part of your body. Of course, things can get stuck, and that's why they're looking for the pennies to come out. Diamond thieves can swallow diamonds. Idiots can swallow packets of drugs. And so forth. And, you know, unless you break these things down and absorb them, they're not a part of the body. So remember that. The only time it becomes a part of the body is when it literally gets absorbed into the body. Otherwise, it's on its way out. So kind of like a tube within a tube. And you can kind of see that structure. Any questions about that? Yeah. So before we break, let me just talk real quickly about the accessory organs. So we've kind of gone through a quick and dirty look at the digestive tract itself, and we'll be coming back to it. But let's fill in the rest of the details with the accessory organs. And I've mentioned them now on our diagram, so let's talk a little bit more about them. So the liver. The liver is an incredibly important organ to the body, because not only is it involved in digestion in certain ways, but it's involved in detoxifying so many things that get into our body and so many other kinds of things. It's involved in helping us to maintain proper levels of sugar in the blood, just a lot of functions. But I want to focus on the digestive function of the liver. And the liver produces bile. Produces bile. And you're going to actually be introduced firsthand to bile this week, because part of the experiments that we're doing in lab are going to involve using bile salts to see what their effect is on digestion. Liver produces about 500 milliliters of bile per day. That's a half a liter. That's about a pint, give or take a little bit, about a pint of bile a day. That bile does a number of things. It's important. One thing that it does is it helps raise the pH of the food mass coming from the stomach. Helps. We're going to talk in a few minutes about what goes on in the stomach and how incredibly acidic that the environment is in the stomach, very, very acidic. And as that food moves on to the next section, we've got to deal with that acidity. That acidity would just eat up the rest of the digestive tract. So one of the first things that happens is we neutralize that. And bile is involved in helping to neutralize that. It's an alkaline fluid that's produced. So it helps to raise the pH of the food. It emulsifies large drops of fat into smaller drops.
emulsifies. The word emulsify just means it's breaking it down. So in our food, we always, you know, unless you're on a totally fat-free diet, I don't know how you manage to do that, but you've got fat, and that fat will not dissolve into water, right? So you get these droplets of fat that are moving through. And remember, it comes back to the surface area to volume thing again that I talked about earlier. The more surface area you have, the more efficiently the enzymes can work on whatever it is. So by breaking the large drops of fat down into smaller drops of fat, that means that the enzymes that are going to break that fat down can work much more efficiently and accomplish the process much, much faster. And that's something that you'll see in lab. You got to watch really carefully the tube that you're going to prepare that has the bile salts in it. Watch very carefully. You'll see a significant difference in speed when the bile is there as opposed to when the bile isn't there. So it emulsifies those large drops into smaller drops. And the third thing that the bile does is it aids in the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins. Okay, fat-soluble vitamins. Some of the vitamins that we need, vitamins are simply small organic molecules that we can't make ourselves, but that our bodies absolutely need to function properly. So we have to get our vitamins from our food. Some are water-soluble, some are fat-soluble, and we need all of those. So bile helps in the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins, and here we're talking about vitamins like A, D, E, and K as some examples of fat-soluble vitamins. We want to be sure and be able to get those vitamins absorbed. So bile, one of the many things that the liver does to produce bile, is very, very important to us. As the liver produces that bile, it feeds it over to the gallbladder. So the gallbladder is a much smaller structure. Like I said, it's underneath, it's tucked up underneath the liver, actually oftentimes embedded kind of in the liver, but you can always tease it out to see that it really is a separate structure. Gallbladder then receives that. It stores bile that's coming from the liver, and it concentrates it. Concentrates it by anywhere from 6 to 15 times. Which is a good thing, because the gallbladder really isn't a huge organ. Liver's producing 500 milliliters a day of bile. There's no way the gallbladder, even if you broke that up into just several sittings because you have a couple, three meals, there's no way that the gallbladder can hold that much. So it's concentrating that bile, and then when you have a meal that has fat in it, that gallbladder is stimulated to contract, and that forcefully squeezes the bile into the small intestine and helps with that digestion. So the gallbladder itself stores anywhere roughly 30 to 60 milliliters of bile. So you can see it's a much smaller organ than would be required if it weren't concentrating it. So liver and gallbladder both involved in bile and fat digestion. And then the pancreas that we talked about earlier, it produces alkaline fluids, which are also going to help to neutralize the pH of the mass coming from the stomach. But what you normally think of the pancreas as producing are just a variety of digestive enzymes. Okay, and it does. So it's producing both of those things that are really important for the digestive process. Okay, let's take that break I've been promising you, maybe 5 minutes or so. And we come back, I'm going to start looking at processing. What's going on actually in processing? Okay, let's try to come back. And I discovered that I had given maybe perhaps a misimpression about the throwing up process and so forth. You know, your your body doesn't usually, your cardiac sphincter doesn't usually just say, oh, I think I'll relax now and see what happens. But when you throw up, it's because that's what's happened. So that something has caused that to relax. And so it's, you know, I don't know, maybe your body does play tricks on you once in a while, but that'd be a great trick, I'm sure. If I were a cardiac sphincter, I might consider that. So let's look at digestive functions now. So we are over here on page 9. I have a couple comments to make first, and then we're going to do a quick review of what you learned in Biology 101 on enzymes, because enzymes are so much involved in this whole process. So we've talked about chewing, right? Chewing mechanically reducing the size of the particles. And it's really, really important to do that. You're gonna be a lot more successful digesting things if you chew your food than if you just swallow it. Don't be like the guys on the hot dog eating contests that put 60 hot dogs into there. I don't know how they even do that. But I can guarantee you they're not digesting them. I don't even want to know what they're doing after the contest. So chewing, mechanically reducing large particles of food into smaller. Really important. Saliva. Let's talk about saliva for a minute. So we have three sets of salivary glands around our mouths. A pair in our cheek. We have a pair that are underneath our jaw. And then we have a pair that kind of reach down into the neck. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. Sometimes you might take down a bite on a piece of food after not having eaten for a while, and you feel a pain in your cheek or underneath. Sometimes that's your salivary gland contracting, usually. And I don't know why that happens from time to time, but you may have experienced that sort of a thing. Just a sharp pain, and it's gone, and that's the end of it. So the salivary glands are responsible for making saliva. We all know what saliva is, right? Saliva is used for many things. Lubricates the food. So for the liquefaction process, we're starting that liquefaction process when we're chewing, and that food mass is getting slimier and liquidier and so forth. Really important, though. So liquefaction is a big deal. And then swallowing, too. So the saliva helps to lubricate the food for swallowing. Right, so we want to do that. We don't want to try to swallow our food dry. So it's important from that aspect, but it's important from other aspects, too, because the saliva is not inert. It contains some things and a couple of enzymes that are involved in the digestive process. One of them is an enzyme called amylase. And another one is an enzyme called lipase. Now, amylase starts the digestion of starch. So if you have any starch in the food that you're eating, which generally, most often you do, the amylase in the saliva, as you get that mixing in with the food, chewing, that's going to start digesting that starch and breaking it down into smaller subunits. You may remember from last term, starch is a very, very large polymer. It's a whole bunch of glucose units. Glucose is a monosaccharide. It's a single six-carbon sugar. And starch is literally thousands of these glucose units hooked together, one after the next, after the next, after the next. And the amylase, the enzyme, will break these down into two glucose units that we call maltose. So amylase will take starch, it's a large polymer of glucose, and break it down into maltose. So that's two glucose connected together. And when we're looking at an enzymatic reaction, generally we see this reaction, okay, starch is getting broken down to maltose. We'll put the name of the enzyme over the arrow so that we know that that's what's going on. Okay, so amylase. If you take, say, like a saltine or something, and you start chewing, and you resist the temptation to swallow, if you chew it long enough, it will start to taste a little bit sweet. And that's because these maltose subunits are getting released, And we taste maltose as sweet, as a sweet sugar. So you can kind of experience that. Lipase takes fats, triglycerides. Remember, animal fats are solid triglycerides. Plant fats are liquid triglycerides. Plant oils, liquid triglycerides. Remember, they're composed of three fatty acids connected to that little three-carbon glycerol molecule. So triglyceride, three fatty acids. And lipase will take that triglyceride then and break it down into two fatty acids plus one monoglyceride. So it will break two of the three fatty acids. It will just disconnect two of the three fatty acids from the triglyceride, and that's what it will produce. We can absorb these. We can absorb the fatty acids and the monoglyceride. We cannot absorb the maltose, so that's going to have to get processed further later on. But food's only in your mouth for a short period of time anyway, so there are other places where this happens as well. Both enzymes, critically important to getting things broken down to where we can absorb them and utilize them. Without enzymes, life as we know it wouldn't exist. Point that I made last term, I'll make that point again this term. We've got to have the enzymes. Now, there at the top, page 9, is a review of enzymes from Biology 101. So let's go through that quickly. You tell me the answers. Almost all enzymes are what?
Proteins.
They're proteins, right? Proteins of one type or another. There are some RNA enzymes, but they're rather rare. Enzymes speed up chemical reactions by doing what? Lowering the energy of activation. Reactions, even though they look like they'll go forward, they typically need some energy input to get them started. And enzymes just make that requirement lower and lower, and the lower they make it, the faster that reaction is going to go. So enzymes don't make reactions happen that wouldn't ordinarily happen. They speed up reactions that are already happening, but happening really, really slowly. Enzymes are by the reactions they mediate. Where am I heading with that? Are they changed or not changed? Oh, sure, two blanks. They're not changed, right? So a little bit of enzyme goes a long ways. It just keeps going and going and going. They are not changed by the reactions that they mediate. One enzyme can mediate thousands, tens of thousands of the same reaction over time. Enzymes are very, what, in the reactions they mediate? What would go there? Specific, yes. They're very, very specific. So I talk about two enzymes here, amylase and lipase. The only thing amylase will do is break starch down into maltose. The only thing lipase will do is break triglycerides down into the two fatty acids and the monoglyceride. They don't take turns. They don't go back and forth. Very, very specific. The activity of an enzyme is affected by what? We talked about pH. We talked about temperature. It's external environment. Right, so we can make an enzyme more or less active just by modifying the external environment, by changing the pH, by having a very acidic stomach and an alkaline small intestine. That affects whether those enzymes can function or not. Temperature. We last time we talked about how enzymes tend to have an optimal temperature where they work best. Either side of that temperature, they don't work as well. And if the temperature gets too high, they get completely destroyed. They get denatured. They don't work at all. So the external environment's really important. Some enzymes require other small molecules called, what do we call those small molecules? Cofactors, right? Cofactors. Remember cofactors? Now, I need you to add something here. Other small molecules and or ions. Would you add that there? Because some enzymes require ions. Some enzymes require other small organic molecules and so forth. Some might actually require both. So there may be other things that are required to make an enzyme work really well. And we'll come across some of those, I think, as time goes on in this class. And then finally, what are enzymes usually named? What's their suffix? ASE, right? So if you see a word that is kind of a long word, and you think, what in the world is this? And it's got an ASE ending. If it's in the biological context or something, it's probably an enzyme, because we tend to, the name of it tends to be what that enzyme is doing, and then end it with an ASE that tells us it's an enzyme. So you look at lipase. Well, that's breaking up lipids. Triglycerides are lipids, so it's doing that. Amylase, you say, oh good, that's not starch. Well, the proper chemical name for starch is amylopectin. And so that's where this comes from. Amylase is breaking up the amylopectins into maltose, and that's what they're doing. Not all enzymes are named that way. Some of the enzymes that have been around for a long, long time that we've known about have names that go back far historically, have totally different names. For example, amylase used to be called Tylan. That's, so you may run across that Tylan. It starts with a P, it's a silent P. Tylan is an old name for amylase, but most of those enzymes that got named a long time ago don't have new names to them. Now, I think I've got enough time. I wanted to demonstrate this idea that enzymes speed up chemical reactions that are, that's what they do. And this is something that you're going to do, at least this only little part is something that you're going to do in lab. So I thought I would set this experiment. What I'm going to do is I've got some cream here, and I have some material called pancreatin. Now, you haven't heard that term yet. Pancreatin, something that you're going to use in lab. Pancreatin is just freeze-dried pancreas, ground up. Okay, so you can imagine you collect pancreas, you freeze-dry them, you grind them up, you bottle them, you sell them for a lot of money. But the process allows the enzymes that the pancreas had in it to remain viable. And so this pancreatin material that we use has a lot of different enzymes in it. One thing that the pancreas produces is amylase, and we'll talk about where we use pancreatic. This is salivary amylase. This is coming from the saliva that we've been talking about here. And we'll talk about pancreatic amylase also. Same thing with the lipase. So we've got some lipase that's being produced in the saliva, but we also, the biggest shot of lipase comes from the pancreas again. So both of those enzymes are present in this pancreatin solution. And so in lab, we're just going to use this as a source of our two enzymes without going to the expense of buying purified enzymes, which are really expensive. We're just going to use this. So what I'm doing, I'm taking that freeze-dried pancreatin right now, and I'm reconstituting it. This is what your lab instructor will do. And then you're going to get a little flask of this reconstituted pancreatin. Because it's freeze-dried tissue, we never get everything into solution. There's no way. So when you look in your little glass that you get, you probably see little lumps of this and that and so forth. Don't worry about it. That's not lumps of enzyme. That's lumps of pancreas tissue that just hasn't gotten reconstituted. And I'm not going to do the greatest job in the world of mixing this because I'm kind of running short of time here. There we go. Okay, so we've kind of got our reconstituted pancreatin now. We're going to look at the digestion of fats. And I told you that when the triglycerides are broken down, they release fatty acids and a monoglyceride. Fats in milk start off slightly alkaline. If you're releasing fatty acids, the acids are going to turn the solution slightly acidic. So we can use a pH indicator that changes color between alkaline and acidic to monitor this reaction going on, if indeed the reaction's happening at all. And that's what you're going to do in lab. So what I'm doing is putting some cream into my cylinders. I've got two cylinders because one of them I'm going to put the pancreatin in, the other one I'm just going to put water in, so that's going to be a control. We'll see what would make sure that it's actually the
lipase that's doing the reaction and not something else. So this is our pH indicator. Okay, it's called bromothymol blue, a nice blue color. And we'll be able to see here once I get to mixing it all together, you'll see that indeed the cream is going to be a blue color of one sort or another. But I'm going to hold that aside. Now, those have both been prepared the same. Like I said, one of them I'm just going to add water to, so I'm going to add 50 mils of water. And I've marked this to control, by the way, so that I know which one has the water and which one has the mercury. Yeah, it's always important to mark your glassware so that you know what's what. Okay, the only difference between these two now is that we've added the enzyme, right? So here's the enzyme. And I'm going to seal these off. Parafilm is fun stuff. You're going to get to use parafilm in the lab. It's kind of a waxy material that you can stretch and seal things with. And you're going to be mixing a lot of tubes, so you're going to want to use parafilm to help you with that. Now, let's see how well I got this. This is kind of like the blender last time. How well did I get this sealed? Am I going to turn blue? Okay, so there's one tube. And this is the experimental one. Okay, this is the one that has the enzyme in it. And strange. It looks like there's cream in there that was just confusing the mix. Wouldn't you know it? Yes. Okay. Now, so you can see that right now they're pretty much the same color. So I'm just going to let these sit here now while we go through and finish the lecture, and let's see what happens. Okay, so the control here, on this side, that maybe I should. Nah, I'll leave them here. Nah, I'll put them over here. Watch me knock them off. Okay, control, experimental, and let's just kind of keep an eye on them. That way I can keep an eye on them too. Okay, back to whatever it was that we were doing. So we have these enzymes that are in the saliva, and they're going to start this digestive process going. What do? We swallow the food mass. It goes down to the stomach, and the stomach is highly acidic, a highly acidic environment. Now, these enzymes work best at slightly alkaline pH. And so when the food mass hits the stomach, it basically poisons the enzyme. The enzymes are no longer effective because the pH is so low, it's so acidic. So they're no longer in the stomach, they're no longer doing what they're doing in the saliva and on its way down. So let's talk about the stomach for a minute. Stomach produces gastric juices. Gastric juices, it sounds so tasty. These are produced by the cells lining the stomach. Okay, that was the mucosa, right, that we talked about. What kind of cells are the innermost layer of the mucosa lining the stomach? Well, the four tissue types, what would they be? What was that? Epithelial cells, exactly. They're lining it. And some of those epithelial cells are involved in producing the gastric juices or gastric fluids. Now, if we analyze the gastric fluid, here's what we find. Hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid. You know that hydrochloric acid is a very, very strong acid. And the cells of our mucosa are producing hydrochloric acid. That's why the pH of the stomach is so, so low. Okay, it's that hydrochloric acid. Why would we want to do that? Glad I asked that question. There's several reasons. So what the hydrochloric acid is doing, first of all, it's breaking down plant cell walls and connective tissue and meat. Thank you.
It breaks down plant cell walls and connective tissues in meat. And that helps with this whole solubilization process that we've been talking about. It helps to break the meats down, it helps to break the plant materials down so that we can access the contents and take full advantage of the nutrients that are contained therein. Oh my goodness, look what's happening with our control, one with enzyme. Notice the color change is starting to occur? The end point of this reaction, if we get there, is a bright yellow. So keep an eye on this and see if we get there. But the reason the color's changing is because the fat's being broken down, the fatty acids are being released. Okay, so back to this. Breaks down plant cell wall material and connective tissue in meat. A second thing that hydrochloric acid does, really strong acid's going to do, is just kind of non-specifically break larger molecules apart. Okay, so just very non-specifically. You know, if you put some tissue, say, into a vat of hydrochloric acid, pH 1, come back later, it's gone, right? It's been digested, just non-specifically. So the hydrochloric acid will do that. Even more important, though, than that is that it solubilizes minerals and makes them available for absorption. Solubilizes minerals. I wonder, I worry a little bit about people that are acid blockers and stuff. I know it really helps them, but by reducing the acidity in the stomach long term, I wonder if we're not going to find that these people are going to start showing up with mineral deficiencies that they wouldn't normally have had, because a lot of the minerals that we need to get into the body really need this acid treatment in order to solubilize them so that they can be absorbed. So it's something to think about. And the final thing that it does, and this is really good, it kills all sorts of things that might be in your food. So, kills bacteria, fungal spores, various kinds of parasites that we might find in the food that we're eating. Doesn't get them all necessarily. And in fact, there's some things that have to go through a very acidic environment like the stomach in order to germinate, like tomato seeds. They love to go through an acidic environment to simulate them to germinate. But many, many things are killed that way. And so it's kind of a first line on defense from these kinds of things being able to invade our bodies that might be found in the food. So. Again, a very, very important aspect. So, gastric juices, hydrochloric acid. And that's what it's doing. Second thing that we find in these gastric juices is mucus. Now, why would we find mucus in here? Well, with the low pH of the stomach would attack the cells that are lining the stomach, would attack the mucosa. And in fact, you know, ulcers are places where the lining does get attacked. This mucus tends to coat that lining and protect it from the acidity of the environment. So it's a very good thing to have in there, protect the stomach from hydrochloric acid. And the third thing that is in these gastric fluids is an enzyme called pepsin. Now pepsin starts off its life as an inert substance that's produced by cells. It's called pepsinogen. But once that's been released, once it's into low pH, it's converted to pepsin. Pepsin begins the digestion of proteins. So pepsin, proteins, in the presence of pepsin, will begin to get broken down. What will happen is that the pepsin will identify certain amino acids. And once it finds that particular amino acid, it'll cut the bond holding that to the next one. So it begins breaking proteins down into polypeptides. But we've got a whole lot more processing to do with the protein than that, so we'll talk more about that next time. So before you go, let's take a look at what's happened over here. You know, we didn't really have a whole lot of time. It was less than 10 minutes that this reaction's been going on, and you can see that there's been a really pronounced change in the two. Now, how do we know that it was the enzyme that caused this reaction to occur? Because we can look back at this one and say, well, this didn't have it, right? The only difference was the enzyme, and so it had to be. Importance of an experimental control. Okay, I'll stop there. See you all either later today or Thursday, where we'll pick this up.